The committee will come to order. We're going to wait on the minutes for a little bit. So, Representative Fritz, whenever you're ready to go. And members, I think this bill is actually, we won't be voting on this bill today because I... Right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I'm pleased to be here today with House Bill 266, and I do understand that this is an informational hearing on the subject of parental fees. And I, to my right here, I want to also introduce someone from my hometown of Faribault. Her name is Wendy Susan. I want to tell you a little bit about how I met her. All of us who have run for office, attend many of our hometown festivals, our church breakfasts, and we have a number of those wonderful festivals in Faribault as well. And I was actually at the Tree Frog Festival. I invite you all to come and attend that in Faribault. A lot of good music. And I was tapped on the shoulder and pulled by the arm by a young woman who said, "I need to speak with you." And we all know that we do get that quite often as representatives of our district. And so Wendy has a son who is now, who is 24 years old with Down syndrome. I come from Faribault, where we had a Faribault State School and Hospital many years ago. And when I graduated from the Licensed Practical School of Nursing, that's where I went to work for my first job ever. And we had about 3,500 clients in the hospital and in the setting, the buildings there. That's no longer there now. That is the site of the Faribault Correctional Facility. But those clients went out into group homes and throughout the state of Minnesota. Parents then who did have and deliver a disabled child, for the most part now, I believe, are, like Ms. Susan, trying to raise them at home. But they require services, and those are services that vary from a Hoyer lift or some sort of a lift to get them in and out of a bathtub, to braces, all the ways from that down to the size and weight of diapers for that child to wear, and as that child grows into adulthood, the changes in the services that are required for that disabled child. Oftentimes, these parents need those services, and those are waivers. And those are expensive. They cost money. The parents not only have to pay for those services, they also have to have a hospital plan and pay those premiums. So they're actually paying twice. And I have a number of constituents of mine that have come today. Through the efforts of Ms. Susan's, we have been meeting in Faribault on a regular basis, and we've come together to put this bill before you and to give the information to you that we hope that you will take home. Thank you. Wendy.
So welcome to the committee. And if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Wendy Susan. I am a parent of a young man named Ken who does have Down syndrome. He also has generalized anxiety, ADHD, sleep apnea, and sensory integration issues, particularly with touch, sound, and movement. Our family made the tough decision when parental fees were first legislated. We sacrificed to keep our son on his waiver program, even though fundamentally I disagreed with the bill that created an inequity to families with children with developmental disabilities. If you are on the waiver, you have no choice but to pay the parental fee. I had, and I still have, good insurance, which my son is on. Our family has always been low users of the waiver. We take care of many of Ken's needs ourselves, but in order for my son to receive the benefits of the waiver due to him by qualifying for, at that time it was the mental retardation related conditions waiver, it's now the developmental disabilities waiver, we became responsible for carrying two insurance policies for Ken, Blue Cross Blue Shield and TEFRA. There was no choice. He could not be on the waiver without accepting TEFRA or MA. When parental fees became mandated, my son was a teenager with only a couple of years left before he would be needing adult services, including vocational day training and habilitation. We could not give up the waiver, as then Ken would once again be on a waiting list for services he would need once he became an adult. We made the sacrifice then, as so many families continue to do today. In my professional life, I am an early childhood special education teacher, and previously I was an individual family service plan facilitator for Rice County. I provided families with information about the waiver services and about TEFRA. These were services I would recommend to families with children needing specialized care. I felt good about making the referral, knowing the benefits to the families and the child. After the mandate of parental fees, I no longer feel good about making these referrals and do so very hesitantly and with much caution. In part because of the increased fees that were legislated a few years back. In 1995, Mission, Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs, conducted a study on TEFRA, and it showed that families with children accessing TEFRA incurred expenses 5 times more than families without children with special needs. The availability of TEFRA should not be a barrier to health services, nor should the parental fee be a deterrent to families whose children need specialized medical care. Children using TEFRA option and DD waiver are among our most disabled of Minnesota children. They are children who are likely to be experiencing multiple diagnoses and conditions impacting all facets of their lives. 80% of children on TEFRA have more than one diagnosis. In 1995, families with children on TEFRA spent more than 11% of their adjusted gross income on medical care, and that is not including care for other family members. At the same time, typical Minnesota families spent 5.5% of their income on medical care for the entire family. There is an inequity here. In the past, in order for children with disabilities to receive education or treatment, their parents had to surrender them physically and legally to the care of the state. Now, with the commitment to community-based care and advances in technology, maintaining a child with chronic illness or disability at home is commonplace. Society now expects us to care for children with chronic illness and disabilities in our home and be included in community life. The cost of health care for children with special needs has increased beyond the financial reach for many families. TEFRA has, for some, become a supplemental health policy funding the acute and chronic illness. And I want you to know that Minnesota is only one of 5 states in this nation where parents pay a monthly fee for TEFRA participation, and it is based on their income and family size. In 1995, parents of children on TEFRA were required to pay that fee, and the average parental fee was about $594 per year. I have friends on TEFRA whose family fee is now over $500 per month. This really is unacceptable. Most middle-class families where both spouses are working cannot afford TEFRA. I am appalled by the hardships families this state has once supported in the past are forced to live in today by the result of unreasonable fees. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. The next testifier is Karen Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Karen Larson, and I'm from Fairville, Minnesota. Thank you very much for letting me tell you about the Larson family story. Here is what it's like for our family to sit around the kitchen table. I grew up on a farm in southeastern Minnesota, and my parents taught us 4 things. The family is number one, to work hard, be independent, and never, never ask for help unless you need it. I was living the family dream. I went to school, I got my LPN license, I met and married the man of my dreams, Tim, and we had 7 children together. Then our family was given a little shakedown. In 1984, I was pregnant with twin boys. I caught a virus and was sick. Was not sick, but the twins were. The virus caused Matthew to be stillborn and Andrew be born with mental retardation, cerebral palsy, legal blindness, seizures, unable to walk, and unable to communicate with words. Andrew needs someone with him to do care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to assist him with all his daily living skills. Andrew also has a great smile and award-winning personality. The doctors repeatedly told us that we need to put Andrew in an institution. I thought about my parents' number one rule. Family is number one. Andrew was our son. He was our family. He was going to live with us. And we raised Andrew just like the rest of our children. He had chores, he went to church, he went to the school, and he went to stores. In 1987, we were told that Andrew would not be able to walk. He needed a wheelchair. Again, living by my parents' code, we tried to do it ourselves. After all, we had insurance to pay for things that Andrew needed. Insurance denied the request of the wheelchair. We went and tried to pay for the wheelchair for ourselves, by ourselves, but we could not afford that wheelchair. I went to social services and asked for help. They said, he's your son and your responsibility. I left that office feeling sad, broken, and humiliated. In 1988, we went back to the same social services office and asked to speak to a case manager. We actually filled out forms this time. We were told the waiting list for MRRC waivers was way too long and that we'd never get one, and the case manager threw their 40-page application in the garbage can. Later in 1988, the doctor said I need to have back surgery right away. I had a disc that herniated and from lifting Andrew. We were assigned a new case manager who ultimately was fired for approving our application for the MRRC waiver. We would use the waiver to purchase needed medical supplies, equipment, and surgeries that Andrew needed. There was talk about those families that were making over $200,000 a year would have to pay a fee for the MRRC waiver. We were a middle-class family, and we were not affected by that, and we weren't worried. But in 2003, the parental fee bill was passed so that all families would have to pay a fee. And that fee was increased from 200 to 700% on top of existing private and health insurance payments. We were scared. We tried to make the payments. We fell behind. The state threatened us with letters saying they would take our house and garnish our wages. In 2003, I talked about the MRRC waiver and what it did to us, what it does for us, and what it does for our family. One person told us, quote, the MRRC waiver was the icing on the cake and that we were going to have to trim off some of that icing, unquote. I told this person that the MRRC waiver was our meat and potatoes. They keep families together, alive, and actually saves the state money. We need MRRC waivers to pay for surgeries and medical equipment that Andrew needed. Now, in 2009, Andrew is 24 and lives with us in our house. We still carry private health insurance along with the MRRC waiver. The MRRC waiver pays for staff that assist Andrew with his cares. The staff work during the day, and Tim and I take care of Andrew during the evening hours, weekends, holidays, and when staff are sick. By keeping Andrew in our home, we save the state $4,000 a month. We do this because we love our son, and he's our family. I'd like to leave you with one quote that Thomas Jefferson said. Quote, the care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government. End quote.
Thank you very much. If there are no questions from members, we will go on to the next testifier, and that is Deb Hawley. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Deb Hawley. My husband Kevin and I have a son, Connor, who is 11 years old and is medically fragile. Connor is developmentally and cognitively delayed. He is nonverbal and nonambulatory. His diagnosis is low-tone hypotonia and cerebral palsy. Our main message to convey to you today is how the parental fee has caused a financial crisis and hardship to our family. We would like you to revisit the calculations of the parental fee program. My husband and I strive to better ourselves. We both work full-time positions. We have longevity in our positions and consistently go above and beyond what is expected. The TEFRA and developmental disability waiver does not create an incentive to want to financially better ourselves. We are being penalized with a fee to keep our medically fragile child in our home. Our piece of our story is that in December 2003, our son was 6 years old and had been hospitalized several times at Children's Gillette Hospital for uncontrollable abdominal distress and vomiting. This would go on for 5 to 7 days. This continues to go on. I finally had to resign my position as a regional supervisor working for the same corporation for 23 years in order to provide the appropriate care for our son. At the same time, our son needed an accessible form of transportation. I could no longer lift him into our vehicle. Now, I'm unemployed and in need of a handicap van. We had a Windstar van. We found a company, Rolex Van Company in Shakopee, that could not convert a Windstar van. The only vans they could convert were the Dodge Caravan because they had a longer wheelbase. Of course, we could not afford it. We had to borrow from our retirement to purchase a new vehicle. The amount for that van was then calculated as part of our total gross income the year. That year, and our parental fee went from $300 a month to $1,100 a month. Additionally, we were penalized for early withdrawal from our retirement account, as you are aware, and incurred additional income tax debt. On top of that, we now owe the state $11,000. You not only suffer from financial debt, but you grieve and strive to keep your child alive and well each and every day. After our son was healthy enough to go back to school, it was 2 months later, I went back to the workforce and am currently working as a full-time paraprofessional. In comparing my current position to my last position, I took an 80% loss in my annual salary, increased costs in automobile insurance in order to have an accessible vehicle, significant loss in family medical insurance, optical and dental, and encumbered in 11,000 debts with the state. Please do not allow this program with these current calculations. Please do not allow a program like this with these current calculations. For an average income family, it causes us financially to suffer and have to make a choice to be either employed or have to stay at home. Please make a change in the current calculations of the parental fees to allow us to continue to keep our children at home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Peterson has a question.
Yeah, so what you're saying that to buy the van, you had to take money out of your retirement account, and that was counted as income, and so for that year it boosted your income for the TEFRA calculation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions from members? Okay. We'll go on then to Lisa Everett. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you. My name is Lisa Everett. I am here today with my husband, Chuck. And I want to thank all of you for listening to this group today. Chuck and I have one child. Her name is Jill. Jill was diagnosed with Rett syndrome at the age of 3. Rett syndrome is a neurological disorder. It severely limits her growth and fine motor skills and has caused scoliosis and leaves her nonverbal. Jill is a charming, lovable, and amazing 11-year-old girl. Chuck and I have lived in Faribault, Minnesota all of our lives. We ensured that we had our lives in order before we had a family. My college degree was finished. We had bought a home, and our careers were on track. Along came Jill. I was 29 years old, but along came Rett syndrome. Chuck and I faced the diagnosis head-on and have never looked back. We ensure that she gets what she needs through the school, the county, or through our involvement with the Minnesota Rett Syndrome Research Association, for which I am the current president. Chuck and I would like to share our view of and experiences with the waiver program and the fee that we pay for it. I have contact with many families in Minnesota who have daughters with Rett syndrome. The parental fees are all over the map. The higher income family will pay a higher fee but receive the same services as a family that pays a lower fee. Rett syndrome is Rett syndrome. The needs of the child are the same, yet the fee paid varies because of the parent's income, not the needs of the child. Chuck and I work full-time. We pay federal and state income taxes, which funds programs like the waiver. We pay a tax on our private health insurance, which helps fund the medical assistance program. And we pay the parental fee. That's three ways that we pay for one program that ultimately does not meet the needs that Jill has. The methodology used to calculate fees is not appropriate. It does not encourage you to get ahead in life. We look at a performance bonus, starting your own business, getting a promotion or a new job in a different light because we know there are negative impacts because of the fees. Like in the Holly family example, your state tax refund is taken immediately if you are in arrears. There are threats of negative impacts to your credit report and even putting a lien on your home if you do not pay this fee. Couples, including ourselves, have had discussions of divorce as a way to get some relief from the fee. Do these scenarios play out for families in other state programs that pay no fee at all? In 2004, the county, Rice County, where we live, approved the purchase of a wheelchair lift for our van using our waiver budget. 3 years later, we had a similar situation and needed to use the funds for a stair lift in our home. That was met with resistance. When I first asked for the chair lift, the county social worker supervisor said, "Could you bounce her down the stairs on a pillow?" After two appeals, we did not receive the lift, yet we continue to pay the fee every month. We previously used our budget for services under caregiver training and education. Parts of that program were cut last year, and our request was denied. Yet we continued to pay the parental fee every month. The monthly allowable quantities for diapers changed last year. If we had kept the same absorbency factor, Jill would have been allowed 2 diapers a day. Again, the services are reduced, yet we continue to pay the parental fee each month. In July 2008, we started the consumer-directed community support program under the waiver because it was the only way we could ensure quality care for Jill. Going from the developmentally delayed waiver to the consumer-directed community support waiver meant a 53% cut in our budget. Yet we continue to pay the same parental fee every month. Our parental fee marches on whether our annual budget goes down, the services decrease, or they're simply denied. Again, thank you for listening to our testimonies, and we hope you support this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Thiessen.
Can I just ask a couple questions? So you say the switch from the DD waiver to the other waiver, your waiver, the what you got reimbursed went down by 53%? And why is, do you know why that is?
Well, there's a different calculation under the two waiver programs, and so my understanding through Rice County is the state has determined how you figure the CDCS waiver that we are now on. They figure that budget, so they're able to plug it in on the website, and in 2 seconds I have that number. I don't know the detail behind it, but the reality of it was the 53% cut.
Well, one question, maybe not for you, but that maybe someone can answer. Is that a uniform calculation across the state, or do counties have a determination of how they come up with that, what those waiver amounts are?
I might have that answer.
Okay. He wants the full grant.
Either one.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. The state calculates the budget for the Consumer Directed Community Support Service, which is actually a service under the DD waiver and all the waivers. For the other services, when somebody isn't on Consumer Directed Community Support, it's up to the county to determine what services the individual needs and what they'll pay for those services.
Okay, so if I'm, Madam Chair, so if I'm understanding, in this circumstance, then the state's calculation was significantly less than the county's calculation?
That's correct. That is what happened.
Okay, thank you. And I had another. Do you have anything, Steve, or anybody? Is that the same? Sorry. Thank you.
I'm Steve Larson with the ARCA, Minnesota. And the reason a family like Lisa's would take that cut is because they have more flexibility in how they can spend the money and meet the individual needs of the family. So I'm assuming that's the case in Lisa's situation. And we'll be talking about consumer direction when we review the following bill and have a hearing on that and the benefits of that to individuals.
Can you just address maybe the larger question of county waivers in general, like not the one we just talked about, but the DD waiver and how the consistency of that? across counties? I mean, is someone in one county going to get the same amount as someone in another county?
Representative Pizza, no, it's up to the... If they're on consumer-directed community supports, then there's a budget formula, and so they would receive the same amount. Consumer-directed community supports is a subset of... There's 1,400 people on that out of the 14,000 people on the developmental disabilities waiver. Then, if it's a developmental disabilities waiver in general, then it's up to the county to set the rate if they're not on consumer-directed. So that could vary depending on the individual needs and how much the county has available to spend on them.
But the county has discretion in that?
Yes.
Okay. And then the other question I had, which is totally separate. So you have private insurance, health insurance? Or
we've had it both ways in Jill's time with us. So
right.
Currently we don't, because the amount of that coverage for her doesn't meet the calculation. I don't know how many are familiar with that, but we had previously. So early on, yes, we paid both insurances.
But you needed to have both because the private insurance didn't cover a lot of the services that were needed?
At the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding in the years that we did pay for both, you're required to actually carry that private insurance if it's under that threshold of cost in comparison to your adjusted gross income.
But nonetheless, that insurance didn't cover a lot of the services that are needed in any event.
Right. Oh. Depending on if you had Health Partners, Medicare, Blue Cross, there would be limitations on that policy.
Okay. Thanks.
Hey, there's a question from Representative Abler.
Well, just to help people understand this, I think the DD waiver is paid half by state and half by federal, and the grant program is where you just take the state share, generally that number. And so it's no loss to the state that people want to spend their half, the state half, how they want. And so that's kind of why it's the half number. And I think the counties are awarded a slot, and then they get a certain amount of money per severity of the slot, and then they manage within that big pot of money all the people who are on the waiver program. So it's quite a study for the freshmen. It's fascinating. It's consuming after a while.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have next testifier, Nathan Morocco. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco, and I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division with Minnesota Management and Budget. In that role, I oversee the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which is the employee program for all state employees, as well as yourself. I'm here not to comment on the program itself, but just to direct you to the last part of the language that directs the commissioner of MMB to essentially authorize the parental fee payment to be FSA qualified, that's flexible spending account qualified. I believe you also have a letter from me in your packet, so I won't go into a lot of details on it, but suffice to say, the IRS regulates what is eligible and what is not eligible for a flexible spending account. So as such, we would need to follow Section 213D of the IRS code when determining if these are eligible or not. Historically, we've worked with Representative Vonna Midori, as well as the Disability Law Center, ARC of Minnesota, and DHS. So we're more than happy to continue to participate with those groups and assisting in trying to find ways to accommodate. So with that, I'll leave my testimony brief.
Thank you. Questions from Representative Scott Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, this is something I was thinking of as I was looking at this bill. Are we also pursuing something congressionally on the federal level to change the IRS code to help with this? Is there something that's a companion to what we're trying to do at the state level, at the federal level? Because it occurs to me the code is part of the problem, too.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, as a program, we are not. But I know that there has been talk at the federal level.
Representative Gottwald will be anxious to work with you on that with our congressional delegation. It's a great idea.
Okay. Thank you. All right. If there are no other questions from the committee, thank you very much, testifiers. This was informational, so we won't be taking a vote on it at this point. But thank you. Did you have some concluding comments, Representative Fritz?
Well, I just wanted to thank all of you and thank my constituents from the Faribault area for coming up today to present. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have a quorum, so we want to get a motion to approve the minutes. We have a motion. Representative Gottwald moves the minutes. And all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. And we will go on to Representative Loeffler's bill, House File 295. Welcome to the committee, Representative Loeffler. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 295 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Loeffler moves House File 295 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Loeffler, do your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This bill has about four components, but they're all directed towards one principal goal, which is helping to serve people with developmental disabilities in the most appropriate service to achieve maximum independence and to do it in a cost-effective way. And you'll hear some similar sort of stories on this about the programs that this would increase opportunities for. We have over 5,000 people with developmental disabilities on waiting lists. And that, to me, when I first came to the legislature, I hadn't realized it had gotten that bad. As far as I'm concerned, our human services infrastructure is as creaky and rusted and unstable as our physical infrastructure. And part of why I chose a career in public service was because of my Aunt Lil. And she was born with Down syndrome at a time when state hospital care was the standard approach to families with a Down syndrome or a disabled child. And my Swedish grandparents, I'm told, said, absolutely not, that's not the Swedish way. We keep our children at home, which at that time was considered radical. And I have never seen anyone so happy in my entire life as when my Aunt Lil grabbed me and tugged down my sleeve and says, I've got to tell you something. I've got to tell you something. I'm going to school. And school was a program run by volunteers in the basement of a church a couple days a week. But to Lil, it was the world. It taught, she had friends for the first time, not just family in her life. She developed social skills and confidence, and she just blossomed. The second time I saw Lil just glow at that same level of magnitude was when she showed me her first paycheck. And I was just amazed by how public services could transform lives and create taxpayers out of people we once warehoused. And I just thought that was really impressive. It's really sad that we've gotten to a situation with people that we graduate from special education with lots of hope and promise who've lived in our communities and expect to have a life of challenge and meaning and satisfaction are told instead, while their peers are filling out college application forms, that they might have to get on waiting lists that could be a decade long. And that is a very long time for someone to put their life on hold. And I'm proud of the service system that we've developed. I'm embarrassed that we have so many people who aren't able to take advantage of it. So the specifics on this, the first section of the bill deals with the consumer-directed community support by program. That's the one that we've talked a little bit about in the previous bill. This is where people take responsibility for managing within a budget and care for a person with developmental disabilities in the community, typically in their family's home. And it is expected that that cost will be less than institutional care. But the budget restrictions that have been put on it has meant that many people who were in the past were successfully served in the community at lesser costs when they were required to take, for most it was a 30% reduction from average waiver costs, were forced back into the more expensive service system so that it was less flexible and less able to meet their needs. And you'll hear from a testifier from my district for whom that situation arose. The second and portion, or the next section two of the bill, it just establishes an additional 200 waiver service slots. These are not inexpensive. The Finance Committee will have to deal with this, but I think I'm actually kind of embarrassed it's so small when we have 4,803 people on the waiting list. But I'm hoping that we can continue to use some creativity working with our service delivery partners and perhaps expand our current resources further. We also add an additional 200 persons onto the Family Support Grant Program. This serves people with children at home who have special needs and have need special care assistance. There are 1,700 families on that waiting list currently. And Subdivision 3 adds another 200 people to the semi-independent living services. There's 630 people on the waiting list for this. These are adults who are able to live fairly independently in the community with support services. And so they have achieved maximum independence at a really, really reasonable cost compared to other services. I know we are facing very difficult times, but I have to say that opening the doors to opportunity and to a fulfilling life for people is, I think, one of the most important things that we do. And I hope that as we will continue to find ways, working with the finance division, to continue to respond to our service system and make adjustments in it to make this happen. There's been a lot of discussion about job creation, and the Federal Recovery Act has a lot of discussion and money for infrastructure improvements and energy modification. Those are all important goals. But many of the people that I serve who are unemployed are not prepared physically or in other ways to do heavy construction work, and I think they would love to step up to an opportunity to have a job with personal meaning and satisfaction helping someone else achieve their life dreams. And so it's my hope that we'll be able to put some people to work as well as help people achieve the independence they need. And with that, I'm going to ask Steve Nelson from ARC Minnesota to come up and answer any questions you might have about the specifics of these programs. Otherwise, we're going to go into family stories about the particular situations that have arisen as a result of the shortage of slots.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Do people have questions about the bill? So you want Mr. Larson just to answer questions at this point?
You can make it a
Madam Chair, I'll just, I would like to address the consumer-directed aspect of this. As we've talked to legislators this legislative session, many of you have asked us for creative ideas on how to better maximize the current resources that we have available for persons with disabilities. And one system we have in place that we're greatly underutilizing is consumer-directed community supports option. Minnesota has, as I said in my earlier testimony, 1,400 people that are on that option out of 14,000 on the disability waiver. Several hundred people are on utilizing this option, and I'll explain a little bit more about it in just a second, on the CADI waiver, and 200 on the elderly waiver. This option gives people the opportunity to have a budget that they know about several months in advance before the end of the year, to design their personal support system, to pay their staff at a higher rate, to purchase items that aren't available through other means, and that could include technology to help replace human assistance, diapers, as we heard in some of the earlier testimony, that it's very hard to get through regular medical assistance. And people can be very creative in their employment situations in utilizing this type of support. We believe this should be the standard way of doing business for all Minnesotans with disabilities that are on publicly supported programs, as well as older Minnesotans. And if that were the case, we believe we could serve more people on the waivers than we currently are. And so when we had a discussion a few weeks ago with Representative Loeffler about this bill and the waiting list, We decided to include the consumer-directed aspect in it. Currently, in about 2004, and I might be off by a year or two, the budget formula changed. And so that formula, it worked okay for children, but it doesn't work for adults. And so when an individual graduates from high school, most of those adults that are on a very creative program that is supporting them under consumer direction have to go back to the regular waiver. And so they have to replace the services they have essentially with more expensive services under the waiver categories that are available to them rather than continuing to receive the creative supports that they have. So they're still eligible for services, but to receive the more formal services, the county has to pay more out of their universal county waiver budget. So it really is cost, so we're able to serve fewer people on that particular county's budget. So we think by changing the budget formula, and this is just a temporary fix because we're hoping that the state will, when they implement a new assessment, will fix this, reduce the discount right now that exists, which is 30%. So you go through the budget formula, you get a certain amount of money, it's discounted 30%. We believe if that discount were reduced by 10%, many of these individuals that are turning 21 or graduating from high school would stay on consumer-directed community support, save taxpayers' money, as well as be able to serve more people on the waiver program.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One quick question. So what is it about just the different needs that someone has once they, like housing needs? What is it when people get older that changes it?
Oh, when they graduate from high school, Representative Thiessen, when they, and Madam Chair, when they graduate from high school, they need day supports of some sort. That might be vocational support, that might be going to a day training rehabilitation program, or something that they've created themselves in which they might get an employer to help support them in their employment situation. So that's an additional expense formerly the school system paid for. And so they need a bump in their increase, and that doesn't happen in the current system.
Okay. All right. Other questions for members at this point? Representative Chris.
What is the age that occurs?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative Fritz, it's around 21, but it's when individuals graduate from high school and move into the adult service system.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members, before we go on? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Larson. So we have here Steve Hayes. Welcome to the committee. If you would just give your name for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Steve Hayes, and unlike the agenda, would indicate I'm from Plymouth, not from Minneapolis. I'm married to Maureen, and we are the parents of three children. Our middle child, Brett, just turned 18 and has numerous significant developmental disabilities. Brett doesn't talk or communicate in any way, but is completely mobile, so he's kind of like a toddler in an 18-year-old body. He needs help with every activity in life, bathing, diapering, eating, watching TV, walking, everything. And as he gets bigger and stronger, his care becomes more demanding. Brett has been on the waiting list for the developmental disabilities waiver for actually over 8 years. And we've been told that there are over 5,000 people waiting for that waiver, and that it could be years before he's given an allocation. As my wife Maureen and I age, our biggest fear is our continuing ability to care for Brett. I have arthritic knees and a repaired shoulder. My wife has had three knee surgeries in the last 10 years, and you don't realize it, but the stooping and the bending and the caregiving eventually takes its toll. We are told by our social workers that since Brett doesn't come from a critical situation, he's unlikely to get a waiver anytime soon. It seems that unless we prove our family is dysfunctional or broken, or that both of us are completely unable to care for Brett, that he will never receive the services he needs to thrive in our community. Brett really needs to live in a group home, a place like Hammer Residences on the west end of town, but that isn't possible without a waiver. We love Brett and have made many sacrifices to care for him and keep him in our home. We've never gone on a full family vacation because one of us always stayed behind to care for Brett. We're unable to visit our oldest daughter at college as a couple. For years, we went to separate church services because Brett couldn't handle it and somebody had to stay with him. We always feel like we're the first ones to leave a social event as a couple in the evening because we have to get back home. And our situation is not unlike other parents of children with disabilities. All we are asking for is some basic assurance that Brett's long-term care needs will be met, and that, in our case, is not possible without a waiver services allocation. Now, while waiting for a waiver, we are grateful that Brett receives personal care assistance services In fact, he qualifies for 14 hours a day of services. In the past, when he was under 18, we were unable to access all of those services, and we would use services for 3 months out of the year, June through August, because we could not afford to pay the steep parental fee required of families with children on a medical assistance program. So we would use 3 months of services and take 12 months to pay that $5,000 bill. It's not easy to find capable PCA help. And as Brett gets bigger and more challenging, we worry about our continuing ability to utilize the services and make sure Brett gets the attention that he needs. We ask that you hear our story and the stories of others with children with disabilities. And please, find the resources to start increasing waiver allocations. It really is critical to the health of thousands of families here in Minnesota. Our children's needs only seem to grow as our ability to take care of those needs seems to decrease. Too many families have passed their breaking point waiting for a waiver. We really need help. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. Okay, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if it makes more sense to have the testifiers do their thing. I had some questions about the bill and what it's accomplishing. But
well, then why don't we go through the rest of the testifiers, and then we'll go back and were your questions going to be addressed to Representative Loeffler? Or?
Possibly to Representative Loeffler or the testifiers from ARC. But I can wait until after we're done with
this. Very good. Okay. Thank you very much. Deborah and Jeff Denning.
And while they're coming up, I should say that Jeff has served our state in many ways, and he has served as a member of the State Disability Council as a consumer member in the past.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Denning, and I'm here today with my son, Jeff Gorick, to support House File 295, Consumer Directive Community Supports. I'm always honored to assist my son to communicate and help him to provide information that may help others. Jeff has multiple disabilities and a very unique, complicated communication system. Therefore, we have a very unique family challenge for day-to-day living. My son is a remarkable man with an astute mind, locked within a body. Jeff is my pride and joy, but he also poses major challenges for us and professionals for many years. Jeff and I worked together for the past few days to put together this testimony, apologizing that his communication device is broken and he cannot speak for himself today. The medical assistance process has held us up for many months in our pursuit of acquisition of a new device to replace this broken one. Just a quick aside, Jeffrey has 999 codes in his head, so he is more than capable. It takes us a while to interpret, Sam, but we worked on this together.
Madam Chair, I would lose...
Representative Loeffler.
I would just add that I would lose my mind if I had to wait 6 months for a communication device to be fully able to interact with my world.
Representative Loeffler, I know you very well, and I believe you.
You do.
Please go ahead.
Please let me introduce you to Jeff.
So, what do you have to do?
Five. Nine.
Hello, how is it going?
Well, welcome, Jeff. We're glad to have you here.
Are you glad to be here?
Yes. Okay. My mom asked me how I felt about not being able to be on the Consumer Directive Community Support Waiver anymore, and how I felt about the budget cuts that we have already endured and that are coming my way. I told her that I was, quote, sad and, quote, mad. I'm 38 years old and have lived in every possible institutional and licensed service since I was 3.5 years old. It all failed me. And all I ever wanted to do was to move home to live with my family.
The consumer-directed community support option finally came to us and gave us a chance to put in place the unique kind of services that I need. We finally had hope, things were going very well, and I was making a lot of progress with my skills. Then the state took it all away from me, and I'm back to the old license system, missing out on flexibility, options, and so many services that could help me, but are no longer financially available, putting a burden on my family and my programs. I want to go back on a consumer-directed community support waiver so that I can receive the specialty services that I need.
Okay, so far? Keep going.
Okay. Mom and I have talked a lot, and I now understand that there are going to be more cuts and hurts to my budget, my staff, my family, and my personal financial situation. I just don't understand all of the details, but I do know that what I'm hearing is going to ask me to live with less yet again. No dental coverage, decreased money for personal care staff, and limited access to services. I can't take a drink or even scratch my nose without staff help. I am totally physically dependent. I want to fight to stop people like me from getting hurt anymore. Every year it's gotten worse. Why we're always the first to take the hits, as if we're not valuable, is painful. To say that investing in education at any level is more important than taking care of the most vulnerable in our state says something about our morality and priorities. Let those of us with significant disabilities lay by the sidelines, left to make do with little to do it with. While you invest in K-12 education and college students, well, Mom and I just want to say that while important, some priorities are really out of whack here. We should not have to compete with these other programs. We know that there are difficult decisions to be made, but one that should never even be in the mix is the needs of people like me who are voiceless and the most vulnerable. We shouldn't have to defend ourselves year after year after year, and we seriously wonder why we are so afraid to raise additional revenue to help people like me. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to address the committee and for considering our opinions. Should you need more information, our family will be more than happy to help. Anything else? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff and Deborah. Appreciate your taking the time to come down here today. Okay. We have Pam Taylor next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
We need your name for the record, and then you can go ahead.
Okay. My name is Pam Taylor, and I am from Minnetonka. My husband Lou and I have three sons. Our youngest son, Dan, was born with Down syndrome. He's 23 years old. We assist Dan to meet his needs by supervising and administering medication, getting him out and participating in social and recreational events, helping him dress appropriately. His body does not process temperature changes, and that can be a life-threatening condition, and maintaining a skincare routine. In addition, Dan needs ongoing supervision with general aspects of his functional living, like meal preparation. Dan is one of 5,000 Minnesotans on the waiting list for a developmental disabilities waiver. We've been on the list for 5 years now. Our social worker has told us that Dan is unlikely to get a waiver unless, for example, one of us dies. That's a really pleasant thought. Dan has a dream that he's talked about continually since high school. He wants to move out of our house. He wants to live his own life in the community. All I can tell him is we don't have enough money and cannot get the supports needed to help him do so. Sometimes this makes him very angry and very frustrated. Dan got a job recently and is so proud. And I have to tell you, an aside, he came home that first day and he literally glowed when he walked in the door. Not only is he working now and feeling more productive, but he's also doing what he's wanted to do for so long, which is a clerical work in an office. Despite being a working person now, Dan's income is unlikely to be large enough now or in the future to support his needs to live in the community with the supports that are necessary for him to be successful doing that. What we all want is for Dan to be happy and live a self-determined life. Lou and I are growing older. Our health issues are, not surprisingly, increasing. We both have arthritis and deteriorating knee joints. We've both had knee surgery. I've had surgery on one of my hands. And I have chronic back problems related to the physical care Dan required when he was a child. This all makes caring for Dan more difficult now. We worry about what will happen to him in the future. Making a move to community living in a crisis would be devastating for him. He just does not respond well to unexpected changes. Lou and I ask you to do what is right, to be proactive and find the funding necessary to increase waiver slots so that people like Dan can access the necessary supports to live full lives of their choosing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're going to have now, we're finished, I think, with the citizen testifiers, if we can call them that, and appreciate it very much, everyone coming and sharing your stories with us today. Next on the list here is Bruce Nelson, who is, and I think, going to address the bill itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee and Representative Hoffler. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers who support people with disabilities, including the DD waiver and part of the DD waiver CDCS. And I'm going to be talking to you in a few minutes about some reform measures that we're recommending to the legislature. We've been working on it for quite some time. And the elements of this bill, the CDCS, and then certainly working on the waiting list, are significant portions of doing that. What I wanted to talk about is a little different perspective that Representative Loeffler referred to in her initial comments, and that is looking at this in terms of what they're talking about today in Washington, economic stimulus. And a big part of the stimulus will be to Minnesota a fairly significant amount of new Medicaid or medical assistance money. And some people scratch their heads and why, how is that going to stimulate the economy? First off, I want to say that right now, ARM itself employs 27,000 caregivers in Minnesota. And in your packet, there's an economic impact of disability services, about a two-page document. What this is these are data from the Department of Human Services only for the waivers. You can add an ICFMR, DTNHs, PCA, and others. That it goes county by county, and how much money comes into each county, either state and federal dollars. Hopefully the federal share will now increase some. And 75% of all of this money goes directly to caregivers. Caregivers who are modestly paid, as you well know, $10 an hour, $9 an hour, and being modestly paid, they spend that money locally. And I can tell you from our perspective of our members all over the state that sometimes collectively the providers of support to people with disabilities is one of the biggest employers in individual counties. Of course, the be-all and end-all is the needs of people that we're having a hard time addressing. But if you look at this, I'd like you to make sure that you look at this perspective of $1.3 billion, if you add in the ICFMR numbers, going into communities, 75% of which goes to caregivers, and almost all of that stipulates in local economies. very important in this time when every day we're picking up the paper and we're learning about people losing their jobs. And if we don't move forward with sustaining these programs, and as Pam just commented, not only are these caregivers, but these are people with disabilities now who are also out working as taxpayers and contributing to society. So as you consider this bill and other things as we move forward in the disability world, I hope you do, in the back of your head anyway, think of the economic benefits of these programs.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Okay, Representative Blaffler, do you have, first let me ask if other people have questions. Representative Gottwald, do you want to ask your question now?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Blaffler, it appears what this bill is really trying to get at is reducing these waiting lists for these waivers. And I'm wondering, the number 200 is in here in a couple of places, we don't have the dollar amounts, but is this stemming the flow? Can you give us some idea of how fast these lists of waiting, the waiting lists are growing? And will this bill help reverse that? Or is it just kind of holding us stable? Is it making real progress? Does it need to be bigger? Does it need to be less?
Representative Lawson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Gottwald, I'll put my policy frame on it, and I'll let Steve give you some of the specific numbers. I have some that I'm not sure if they're as up to date as his. This will not be enough to stem the increased waiting list. We're every year graduating people from special ed programs and with needs and hopes and to go on to more independent living. We are still discovering parents in the community who have been caring for an adult disabled child for 20, 30 years, sometimes without any community support. I met someone when I was door knocking, but that was the case. Anything. I mean, they've just been doing it as a parental obligation. They tend to sometimes come to attention as healthcare crises come about. They do tend to get advanced in a crisis situation, but that isn't the best situation for transition, as one of our speakers mentioned. It's my hope that this is just the start of working creatively with the service industry, with advocates, with the Department of Human Services and others to figure out, as we work this through in finance, creative ways to stretch this even further.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, add on to Representative Loeffler's comments. When you look at that 5,000, 500 of those individuals are 23 years old or older, so they're living with aging parents such as myself and some of the people that testify here. I'm now a card-carrying member of AARP. So we need to avoid emergencies and plan for these individuals and make sure that we're doing this in a planful manner. So right now, current law reads that we would get 300 additional waiver slots each year. The governor's proposal that just came out reduces that 300 to 180, but it also reduces it further because out of that 180, now he's proposing in the governor's budget that ICFMRs that close would get their waiver slots out of that 180, and that's not true at the current time. And if I'm misrepresenting that, then I'd like to be corrected. Because we're still learning about everything that's in the governor's budget. So the 200 plus the 300 would be 500, and that's what we're hoping to achieve each year.
And sure.
President Gottwald.
Can you give me some idea of the average wait time on of these 5,000 people? What is the average time that they've been waiting in line for this?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, the Department of Human Services does a study every year, and they have the information on that, and we'll make that available to you. I can't cite it off the top of my head. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, or Mr. Larson, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about the proposed cut that is in the first section of the bill. I'm thinking that is a way for us to probably stretch the waiting list, to stretch the waiver to others on the waiting list. But can you describe what those already enrolled might be losing in order to stretch the money a little bit, please?
Mr. Larson?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, people on the waiting list really wouldn't be losing anything. In fact, some of them would be able to retain some of the creative services they have. And what I mean by that is that there's the formula that when you decide to go on consumer-directed community support, all your information is plugged into the formula and you come up with a number. Let's just use 100 as a round number. And then you get a 30% discount, so now you're down to 70. When you turn 21 or graduate from high school, as we discussed earlier, then you have to take that $70 that you're already spending in order to meet your needs and try to add on days of support or employment or whatever because you no longer have the school support. So then people go off of the consumer-directed community support. They're still eligible for the waiver, so the county ends up spending maybe $100 or $110 in order to meet their needs, in which they were paying $70 plus they could have maybe paid $20 additional in order to pay for support. So they really aren't going to lose any services. It would actually, by preventing people to have to go on more formal and expensive services, we might be able to serve more people on the waivers as a result.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Follow-up, Representative Murphy? No. Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Abel.
Sorry, I had to step out. I just wanted to offer a comment about context. And I remember sitting in that chair working on similar bills and there was a different group in charge. And in 2003, I think it was, we tried to soften the blow of the impact of the parental fee. And I just want to remind members that the House has been extremely friendly over the years toward the needs that we heard today, and they're compelling. I think that that the community will recall that the ears have been open and sympathetic and empathetic and all that, we have devoted a good deal of the House proposals and the budget times toward this, and had a more difficult time across the street, sometimes with a closed door on some of the proposals, especially the parental fees, and just wanted to mention that, just so people remember that that we're kind of the champions of these folks, and I hope we can find some way to help them out.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Other questions for members? Okay, we'd like to move to the vote on this bill. And
Matthew, just one more question.
Yes.
Quick question. So, come up with 10%, any particular reason, versus 30?
Representative Loeffler?
Madam Chair and Representative Keeson, I rely on the experts in the field, and they know a lot more personal situations than I do. But it has been a break point for many.
Oh, and that's what I want to, that's kind of exactly the point. So.
And the other thing is that does not mean everybody goes up that extra 20%. It just means that there's a lot more flexibility to relate the actual budget to the real needs of the person served.
Good point.
Mr. Larson, did you want to add to that?
And I'm just thinking ahead, Madam Chair, is there a way to, as we move into the finance piece, is there a way to scale this? I mean, would 20% get us anything, or is 10% kind of a magic number?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, we'll look at those numbers again when this comes to the Finance Committee, but I really don't think it's going to make any difference. The counties still have the same amount of waiver money available to them. If we're able to save some money, as I tried to describe earlier, then they would be able to serve more people. But it is a complicated issue, and we'll revisit it and share any information that we find.
And Madam Chair, just so I understand, on the consumer-directed community support option, that's not county money? Or that's part of the waiver money that's allocated to the county, but they get more flexibility. So it still counts against the number, they just have more money available. Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, there are some programs that are named very similarly. There's consumer-directed community supports is what we're talking about today, which is the federal dollars, which is state and federal dollars, Medicaid dollars, and there's another program called consumer support grants, which is all state dollars, and sometimes those get confused.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Representative Loeffler, do you want to have the final word here before we take the vote?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to thank the committee for their time and for the testifiers who came here. As you can imagine, coming when you have to negotiate wheelchairs and work schedules and other things, it's a real sacrifice. And for Patty's testifiers who came from Greater Minnesota, it shows their dedication to this.
Okay, very good. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 295 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you. We will move on now. We have Bruce Nelson is going to talk about transforming Minnesota's disability service and finance system. Welcome back to the committee. And you may reintroduce yourself, please. And go
thank ahead. You, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson, and with me, I'm the CEO at ARM, and with me is our Chief Operating Officer, Barb Jacobson, who's worked, before coming to ARM, 22 years in the field with a lot of firsthand expert knowledge. ARM is an association of about 150 providers across the state who provide support to people with developmental disabilities, mental illness, brain injuries, physical disabilities, autism, and I can use a menu of acronyms maybe here, but the main services that our folks are engaged in our ICFMR, Intermediate Care Facility for Mental Retarded, and the waivers, the development of the disability waiver, the traumatic brain injury waiver, the CADI waiver, and the CAC waiver, as well as some PCA who are very good business people, I must tell you, at least from the ARM members, going back to the previous hearing, and still. Before we get going, I do want to note that we should all be proud that Minnesota has built a truly remarkable system of supporting people with disabilities, and particularly as we move ahead in our discussion around the various waivers. The waivers were designed and began to be built about 25 years ago, and they were being designed around people who were moving out of institutions. We heard about some people who had, you know, spent much of their life living in a regional treatment center. And, you know, over those 25 years, things have changed. People have changed. And now the people who are coming into the waiver have grown up, thank goodness, with mom and dad, and gone to regular school, been mainstreamed. And so a lot has changed in the world upon which a regulatory system and a finance system was built many years ago. Last summer, we started looking at the world around us and what we've been trying to do as a disability community for the last many years, and looked upon what we saw as the impending disaster financially, having no idea just how bad it was going to be. So we looked at first, what are these dark stars and what are some of the bright stars? The dark star, I think the one looming over us all and over you in particular, is the unsustainability of the system that the financing through Medicaid and medical assistance that supports most people with disabilities. At the federal level, Medicaid will double by 2017 to about $700 billion. And interestingly enough, the elderly and people with disabilities account for 26% of the enrollment, yet 70% of the money being spent. Baby boomers are exempt. Baby boomers are, as you know, I'm one of them. 61 years old, and someday going to probably need some services sooner than later. I hope not, but very possibly. People with disabilities are living longer than ever. A person with Down syndrome born 20 years ago had a life expectancy of around 25 years. Now, about 55 years. This is a wonderful thing. But as people get older, their needs get greater and more costly. We've heard a lot about the waiting list, and that continues to grow. And the other dark star, of course, is the huge deficit before us. On the bright side, we've been talking in the disability world for a long time and moved ahead in some ways, like CDCS, from a duplication, regulatory, bureaucratic type system to one that's more person-centered, that's focused on quality outcomes for people, and the outcomes being what they need and want, and one that's really more cost-effective. So we look at these stars, and maybe they're lining up to provide some opportunity, because we have to do something with the unsustainability of the current system. We have to do something, and it's an opportunity to do some hopefully really truly remarkable and fantastic things that put people more in charge of their own lives in a cost-effective way. So through the last 6 months, we've been working on this draft for discussion, and we mean draft for discussion. It's a report. We put the hundreds and hundreds of hours of some of the best thinking of real innovators in the provider community together to come up with something that we could put into a bill and start talking to people in the advocate world, in county government, in state government, and with you, and to get new ideas, get reactions, and along the way, by the way, we have been sharing this and with people in the department and with people at Consortium for Citizens with disabilities. A bill is now being drafted. Representative Thiessen has been gracious enough to be the chief author. Representative Huntley is a co-author. And so very soon we hope to have not only a report to sit down and talk with you and other people, but an actual bill to bring forward. And we know there'll be some concerns that some people will have. We know some people are going to be delighted. They're going to have good recommendations for changes and whatnot, so that by the time it gets to this committee, it'll be in much, much better shape than this, we think, very good report. The report starts with an introduction saying a lot, or back on a lot of what I've talked about. But note one thing that is maybe keep in your mind as we move ahead. As we thought of a lot of rules and regulations that are often duplicative and trip over each other and are one size fits all, that there's a group of people that each consumer should have, and sometimes better than others, the interdisciplinary team of really making sure we have sound teams around each client, each consumer across the state, to make decisions rather than having them just come out of a one-size-fits-all book.
This is Nelson. Let me just interrupt you for 1 second to let you know that we're really short on time. You have about 5 minutes all together. So
we will jump
to that.
Ahead.
I know there's a lot to cover here.
We do have a lot to cover. But I did want you to have that background. The guiding principles, we weren't going to go over those a lot, but their principles have been around in the disability world for 10 years. We have short-term solutions that might be might or might not be part of the long-term. We have some interim solutions, things we can do this year that will lead to the long-term solution. And a big part of that is a single set of standards that revolve around the individual. Very quickly, if we can do that, go through some of these sections then with you. And
We are going to have to do it very quickly.
Why don't we focus on some of the short term? Well, you can pick and choose, but some of the short term ones that might.
Okay.
Or what?
And we will have other opportunities, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I trust you will, and I very much appreciate this time. DRH funding or MSA shelter needy. If you look at the governor's budget, did some things that maybe some of us agree with and don't agree with. One of the things he did is he put a moratorium. We'll put a moratorium on the development of ship staff, foster care. And it's not a bad idea. But what you've got to do is make sure that people who are moving into less costly services, rather than the, you know, the whole menu of what you get in foster care, you have some basic elements of the funding moving with them. And quite frankly, one reason people are in foster care right now, like under the waiver, is because of GRH funding. And they go there because of the money. If we can be more flexible with that money, that would be ideal. We've been working with the department on a lot of technology, especially in terms of replacing staff when it's appropriate, and working through with advocates and people in the department for staff oversight, things like that. I do want to mention, and a lot of what I'm passing over was Barb's stuff, but one thing that was in the governor's budget, that's the comprehensive assessment. We think is another linchpin to making a system much more cost-effective and much more responsive and directed to people. And rather than having all kinds of individual assessments of people who are, you know, and putting them into different silos, to have people tell me what are your needs and then where are the services and what's the appropriate level of funding. It is in the governor's budget. We think it's very important to move ahead in redesigning our system. I think, you know, the time is short. There's so many things. Let me just, do you want to add anything, Barb?
No.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Nelson, let me just say, you know, first of all, I think, obviously we have the report, and I'm really interested and anxious to read through it. I just want to say, and maybe other members have comments, but it's really encouraging, and I really appreciate the work that's been done here. And without knowing the details of what's being proposed, I think that one of the silver linings that we do have this year is that we're seeing a lot of energy and creativity from a lot of people around some of these big problems and making some good policy changes that hopefully can not only help us with the funding problem, but that can really make people's lives better perhaps in the process, or at least, you know, not have it all be about taking away, but also about doing some things that are new and perhaps better. So I just wanted to say that I really appreciate having this, and I intend to read through it. So don't feel too bad that you're not getting to talk about every piece, and I know that Representative Thiessen will be going through this in later meetings.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it was our hope to be part of the solution, short-term and long-term. And if I've heard anything over the past week walking around the Capitol, it's about mandates. And we think we can be a lot smarter in how we do standards for providers and to support people with disabilities having more independence and flexibility in their lives while we ensure their protection and health and safety. And hopefully, at the very end of this report, we call for a two-year process to flesh out a single set of standards. And if you read it towards the back there, I did have that economic thing inadvertently attached that we had in earlier, but you can just read through the various rules and regulations, and then we'll have discussion out in our world and with you again.
Thank you, and I think Representative Thiessen has this.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair. And we will, I mean, this is going to be coming back in a bill form, if nothing else, but I think it would be really helpful especially for people on the Finance Committee, before we talk about the governor's budget next week in that committee, to go through this, because I think there will be some overlap and kind of shed some light on some of the governor's proposals as well that may be consistent with what's going on in here. But I think that'd be helpful. Right. So thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Testimony, we are adjourned.